Art Berg was raised in San Jose, California, as one of nine children. His parents joined the church not long after they were married. He is an Eagle Scout and served a mission to the South Dakota Rapid City Mission, where he served as an assistant to the president. He's been married for 8 years to Utah's 1981 Junior Miss and 1992 Mrs. Utah USA, Dallas Howard. They and their two children reside in Sandy, Utah. The youngest is 6 days old. He is president of Invictus Communications Incorporated, and is a professional speaker. He may tell you about his work, but he spends a lot of time traveling and speaking. He has been recently named Young Entrepreneur of the Year for 1992 by the Small Business Administration for a six-state region. He has been honored by the Distinguished Utah Quiet Pioneer Award. He enjoys sports, from rugby to scuba diving, and trains constantly for the marathons he enters. Art and Dallas have written a book entitled Some Miracles Take Time. He travels more than 150,000 miles a year, speaking to hundreds of professional and church organizations, including especially for youth and Know Your Religion programs. Tomorrow he leaves for a business trip to Switzerland. Through his motivational speaking and example, he is helping others accept their circumstances so they can take charge of their lives and achieve what may seem to be impossible. We're honored to have with us as our speaker today, Brother Art Berg.
Thank you. Thank you, President Bennion, for that introduction. I'm honored to be here. I really am, and delighted to see so many of you who are here in the capacity at Rick's to learn and to grow. You know, learning is not always an easy process, and sometimes it's challenges in ways that we may not always make us comfortable. In fact, I've discovered in my own life that if I am not uncomfortable a good deal of the time, I'm generally not learning anything. In fact, this lesson was brought home to me a couple of years ago. I was vacationing with my family in Hawaii. Now that was uncomfortable, that was quite nice. Now I come from a family of nine children. And so you have to understand, I was a little skeptical about my family's true intent when they invited me to go scuba diving with them. But I agreed, and so I went through the safety instruction and the training and the education to learn to dive. And finally the time came to dive in the ocean, and so I put the wetsuit on and the air tanks on my back, the buoyancy compensator vest, the weight belt around my waist. They put the little flippers on my feet, and I'm not sure why they put the little flippers on my feet, but they said it looked right. And so then they dragged me out of the water. Now, for those who have been diving before, know that you wear a buoyancy compensator vest. If you let air in or out of that jacket, it allows you to rise or to fall in the water. The jacket was full, and I was floating on the surface. I was comfortable, and I was happy. I was looking to the ocean floor. The instructor, he had a whole new vision for my experience. And so he came up, and he let all the air out of my jacket. And so I began to descend in the water. Now, there was only one problem in my descension. With the flippers on my feet were tending to float more than my head. Now my wife says she has a theory for that, but I don't believe her. And so I began to descend in the water head first. I went straight down to the bottom, 50 feet, and I hit my head on the bottom of the ocean floor. My flippers were sticking straight up in the air. I mean, fish were looking at me strange. The instructor, who was eager to help, he came down and he let the air back into my jacket. Now, I don't know what he thought I was going to do. I went straight back up again. Feet first. I passed my family on the way. And my feet serve as kind of like the hunt from Red October. While my feet were bobbing at the surface, the instructor, he must have been an engineer. He figured if he took the weight belt off of my waist, if he put it around my knees, that I would float flatter in the water. This is a brilliant man. Would have worked too if it hadn't slipped down around my ankles. And now I sank back down to the bottom, and now I was standing on the bottom of the ocean. And I would just kind of wave there like kelp. Now my family was compassionate. From time to time, they would return. And they would pick me up off of my rock and would move me to a new one. Pretty sure I was some kind of a marker. Well, learning is not always easy. It often requires us to be uncomfortable, to challenge ourselves in ways which are not always easy. And so I'm delighted to see so many of you are here in this great institution of higher education in order to make yourselves uncomfortable. That's what it's all about. And I am delighted. I want you to know I feel comfortable and at home in being here with you today. I really do. And honored to be a part. I was speaking for a little company called IBM. And getting littler. Back in Boca Raton, Florida, not long ago, after I had finished with my obligations with them, it was beautiful East Coast community, resort community. I had finished with my obligations. I decided I wanted to enjoy the sunshine, the beautiful weather. I was out pushing along the beach, and I'd gone a short ways when I came to a small cookie shop. Now, I love oatmeal and raisin cookies. And so I stopped and I bought myself a small bag. I had a book with me, so I went out to the end of a fishing pier. I took the cookies, I placed them on a bench beside me, and I began to enjoy the book which I had brought along. Now, a few moments later, a fairly well-dressed young man, he came along and he sat down on the bench beside me. A moment later, this young man reached over and he grabbed one of the cookies out of my bag. He started to eat it. Now, I was a little confused. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know if he was hungry. Didn't know if he thought someone else had left them there. I didn't know if this is what they do in Florida. I didn't know, and so I thought I ought to send him some kind of a message. And so I reached over and I grabbed a cookie out of my bag and I ate it. A moment later, this young man reached over again. He grabbed another cookie from my bag and he began to eat it. Well, now I was frustrated. Well, I wasn't sure if I should say something. I didn't want to offend him. Afraid he might throw me off the pier. So I thought I ought to send him another message. Reached over again, grabbed another cookie from my bag, smiled at him, and then I ate it. Message delivered. Message unreceived. This boy reached over, grabbed the last cookie from my bag, and then he had the gall to ask, "Would you like to have half of it?" Now, I thought of a few things I wanted to share with him. The gospel wasn't one of them. But exercising some restraint, I was probably still somewhat sarcastic in my response when I said, "No, why don't you go ahead and enjoy it?" And he did. And then he left, and I was left to wonder what had just happened. Short time later, after I had finished reading, I closed my book in preparation to leave, and then I noticed that there in my lap, underneath of my book, was my full bag of cookies. But his cookie sure tasted good. Well, I ought to give you a new perspective in a hurry. Well, I'm here today to share with you some of the cookies of my life. Because quite frankly, I've been eating other people's most of my life. And I found that despite my circumstances, that the cookies of my life have been sweet and good. Want you to know that I know that God lives. I know that Jesus is the Christ. That this is His work. And that this is His church. And I'm proud to belong. See, it's about 10 years ago, I felt good about my life and where I was going and what I was doing. I felt good about my spiritual life. I was said my prayers every day. I was active about my responsibilities in the church. I read from the scriptures. I attend the temple as often as occasion would permit. I was active physically. I was a competitive water skier. I snow skied. I played tennis, golf. I bowled on a league. I ran nearly every day. I just started a brand new tennis court construction company. And so my financial future looked rewarding and bright. And I was engaged. Engaged to the most beautiful girl in the world. Jennifer Dallas, my fiance, said yes to my marriage proposal. My father said, "You know, Art, I know what you ought to be in life." I said, "What's that, Dad?" He said, "You ought to be a salesman." I said, "Why do you suppose?" He said, "Well, if you could get a girl like Dallas to say yes to you, why, you could get anybody to say yes to anything." I said, "Thanks, Dad. Now you know where I get my high self-esteem from." Well, I was happy. I was happier than I'd ever been before in my life. And then a tragedy occurred. Or at least some called it that. You know, I'm going to share just a part of that experience here with you today. And then I want you to judge. You tell me. You tell me if it was a tragedy. Whether it's perhaps the greatest experience of my life. You tell me if it was a disaster, as some called it, or whether it's perhaps the most significant blessing I may ever enjoy. See, it was a beautiful Christmas day, and I'd just been at home with my family. That evening, I was going to leave from my home in California, drive back to the state of Utah, to spend the rest of the holidays with Dallas and her family, and to finish her upcoming wedding plans, which was to be in 5 short weeks. You see, Dallas had always lived in Utah, and I had always lived in California. We met, we were just 16 years old. I'd come back to Utah with my family to go snow skiing, and when Dallas and I met, we fell in like. We dated one another, we drove back and forth over the years to see one another, we wrote letters, and we made phone calls. Do you know I'm still paying my father for the phone bills? With interest, I might add. Well, I came home from my mission 4.5 years later. By the way, I served my mission, as was indicated, in North and South Dakota. I have to be honest here. I think I was being punished for unrepentant sins. Is anybody here from North or South Dakota? My good friend Justin over here, there's a few of you. Well, I have to tell you, I was a little skeptical. You see, I didn't know what country it was in. I went to my father. You see, when I was a young man, I had traveled all over the country. We had seen 42 of the 50 United States, and I was excited to serve a mission. I wanted all the places in the world the Lord might send me. But you know, in all the traveling I had done, I had never been to North or South Dakota. I asked my father why we had never visited, and my father said, "Son, when you get there, you'll know." Well, it was a great experience. It really was. And it was perhaps one of the experiences which changed my life perhaps more than any other. So I'm grateful for those who live there, because I won't. I'd come home from my mission happily, and Dallas and I were in love and decided that we wanted to be together forever, and so we were going to be married. And so on that beautiful Christmas day, I knelt with my family in prayer that Christmas evening and Prayed for the kinds of things that you would pray for if you were to take such a trip in your life. Prayed that God would keep and bless us, that He'd watch over us, that He'd take care of us, and that He would protect us. And then with a friend of mine named John, who's still a very dear friend of mine, we climbed into our little car and drove away into the night. Now, I drove for the first 8.5 hours of the trip, and then being somewhat tired, and John having rested during that time, I climbed from the driver's seat into the passenger's, fastened my seatbelt, and then John pulled away into the dark. Now, John drove for about another hour, or an hour and a half. And then he too, being somewhat tired, he fell asleep. Now, I don't remember much of what happened. I felt the car jerk to one side. I sat up and I asked John if everything was all right. Before he had time to respond, the car hit a cement divider, went up and over the top of it, and then it rolled down the side of the road a number of times. The car finally came to a stop in a pile of twisted metal and broken glass. John quickly turned to his right to see if I was okay. But I wasn't there. Quickly pulled himself through the broken window and he called my name in the dark. It's 4:30 in the morning. We were 40 miles north of Las Vegas on I-15. And it was cold outside. John called my name again. And still there was no response. So finally on hands and knees, John groped and searched his way through the dark, feeling his way along, trying to find his friend. And then he heard me groan, and so he rushed to my side. My face was covered with blood, almost beyond recognition. He pulled his leather jacket from his shoulders, and he laid it across my broken body. And then he asked, "Are you all right?" Told him I didn't think so. Told him I couldn't feel my legs and I couldn't move my hands. I asked John if he'd give me a priesthood blessing. And if in that blessing, if he'd promise me in the name of Jesus Christ that I'd be all right, that my legs would be all right, and that I'd walk again. He said he didn't know if he could do that. And so I asked him if he would ask the Lord if he could do that. And so John knelt beside his hurting friend and called upon God Almighty on that early morning hour and asked if he could give such a blessing in my life. Later he said he felt like an empty glass that was being filled with warm water, and then he knew, and I knew. And so he laid his hands upon my head and promised me, in the name of Jesus Christ, that I'd be all right, that my legs would be all right, and that I'd walk again. Now, for those of you who are here today, maybe wondering that if that was the blessing that was given, if those are the words that were spoken, then why? Why am I still in the wheelchair today? I want you to know that I know that God lives. I know that the power of the priesthood is real. And this I know more than I know anything. That when the time is right, when I've learned all that I need to learn, and have done all that I need to do while in this chair, then and only then, God make that blessing efficacious in my life, and I'll walk while in this life. But you know, I learned a few things since I bumped myself on the head on the early morning hour that I'd like to share with you today. You see, what is a miracle? Because that's what I'd like to talk about in the few moments that you and I have to spend together, is miracles. The miracles in my life and the miracles in yours. You see, if you and I were to go back to more than 4,000 years ago, we saw a man stand beside a large body of water. He raised his arms in the air, and the water parted to the right and parted to the left, and 2 million people crossed on dry ground. If I were to ask you, was that a miracle? I think you'd say, well, sure it was. If you and I saw a man call down fire from heaven to consume a worthy sacrifice, if I were to ask you, was that a miracle? I think you'd say, absolutely. If you and I went back to the meridian of times and we watched the man among men, the King of Kings, our Lord of Lords, you and I watched him. As he placed his hands upon the sick and they were healed, the deaf and they heard, the blind and they saw, the lame and they walked. If I were to ask you, were those miracles?
I think you'd answer with a resounding yes. But let me ask you this. Is it a miracle when a small caterpillar grows and evolves to become the beautiful butterfly? By the laws of nature, it is. Is it a miracle when the ugly duckling grows and matures to become the beautiful swan? Well, I think so. I have four sisters. And lucky none of them are here today. Was it a miracle when more than 150 years ago, a 14-year-old boy walked from a grove of trees and from his experience alone, it has grown, evolved into a church which now exceeds more than 8 million members strong. Was that a miracle? I think you'd have to say absolutely. Then what's the difference? What's the difference between the two? The only difference is time. One took more time. You see, you and I live in an instant world, don't we? We live in a world of instant soup, instant oatmeal. I know, I had to eat the lumpy stuff too. A surprise in every bite. Instant love, instant wealth, in most states they call it the lottery. You and I live in an age of space shuttles, fax machines, satellite transmissions, where the operative word in business is now, and yesterday is considered too late. We live in an age where our young people think that if they don't live in a bigger house, drive a faster car, and earn more money than their fathers by the time they're 28 years old, then they consider themselves to be financial failures. Why? Because we live in a world which teaches us that if we can't have it now, do it now, or enjoy it now, then it must not be worth very much. I'm here today to tell you that's a myth. It's a lie. It's taught only by the voice of Satan himself. Perhaps the greatest miracles of my life have come only after great effort, hard work, and time. Elder Boyd K. Packer recently said that some people think a miracle must be instantaneous in order to be regarded as a miracle. But then he added, and this is the important part, but some miracles can grow slowly. And faith and patience can compel things to happen that otherwise never would have occurred. In order to understand the miracles of my life and perhaps even the miracles of your own, you need to come back with me to more than 10 years ago. It's 10 years ago when I broke my neck on a desert floor. 10 years ago when I was taking my ambulance to a hospital in Las Vegas, Nevada, and there I was pronounced a quadriplegic. It's paralyzed from the chest down. Lost use of my feet and legs. Lost use of my stomach muscles. 2 out of my 3 major chest muscles. Lost use of my right tricep. Most of the strength and the use of my shoulders and arms. And I lost the complete use of my hands. And that was where my new life was to begin. Doctor said I'd have to dream new dreams and think new thoughts. They said that I would never work again. I was pretty excited about that one, though. Because 93% of those, they said, in my physical condition, never do. They said I'd never drive again, that for the rest of my life I'd be dependent upon family and friends to eat, to get dressed, or to get from place to place. They said I shouldn't expect to go many places or to do many things. They said I should never expect to get married, because who would want me? They said that never again in my life would I ever be able to compete in any type of athletic event or competitive activity. For the first time in my young life, I was really afraid. I was afraid that what they said might really be true. You see, at the time, if I leaned forward more than an inch or two, I didn't have the strength to push my body back up again. And so I had to begin to relearn like a child how to do everything in my life. I remember spending hour after hour stacking little blocks on top of one another, trying to learn how to use my hands the way they were again. You know, it wouldn't have been so bad if the little blocks didn't have ducks and geese on the sides of them. And the letters A, B, and C. I remember on one morning they were going to teach me how to eat breakfast again. Now I know that doesn't sound like such a difficult thing. Chewing the food was not the problem. I learned that when I was a Boy Scout. Some of you have seen the phenomena. Some of you are still experiencing the phenomena. It was getting the food from the plate to the mouth that presented the opportunity, and so I sat before my challenge of powdered eggs and day-old muffins. They really expected me to get better. I had a therapist at my side to help me, and so I had two requests of the therapist that morning. The first request I had was that I wanted to eat breakfast by myself. She said, I don't know if that is such a bright idea, Art. So that's all right. I'm not a very bright person. So she agreed. She said, I'll give you 30 minutes in which you eat breakfast by yourself. And I said, thank you. Now my second request, though, was a little more unusual. See, at the time, I was wearing what they call a halo. Now, my mother will attest to the fact that it was not the angelic type. It's a breastplate, one on the front and on the back. Metal bars go up and over your shoulders and up the side of your head with a metal plate which goes around the circumference of your head. Then they bolt into your skull in four different places. Keeps the head from nodding to the front and the back or the left and the right and gives the neck the time it needs to heal. Now, I know it sounds kind of gruesome. Actually, they really are. But I think every bishop in the church ought to own one. See, then when they're sitting on the stand early Sunday morning, they can get some real quality sleep without nodding off all the time. Well, I wore one of those for the next 12 weeks of my life. While they didn't make me a bishop, although I was highly qualified, without the use of my stomach muscles, it makes it a little bit top heavy. So I wore a seatbelt around my chest to keep me from falling forward. Now, that was my second request. I asked if she'd remove the chest strap. Reluctantly, she agreed. And upon removing it, she left, promising to return in 30 minutes. Well, I reached forward and I picked up my fork from off the table. Now, my balance, it wasn't very good. But I knew from the fast approaching plate of food that I was falling. And so now with my face in my plate and without the strength to lift myself, my own circumstances, I had a new perspective on the four basic food groups. You know, I noticed things in my eggs, which I had never noticed before. Well, after I had secured ample breathing room somewhere between the eggs and the biscuit, I thought two things to myself. The first thing I thought was, you know, this may very well be the longest 30 minutes of my life. Second thing I thought was, you know, I may not be in this good of a position in a long time. So I ate my breakfast. 30 minutes later, the therapist returned, surprised to see me with my face in my plate. She quickly rushed to my side and pulled me from my circumstances. She said, "Are you all right?" I said, "You bet, you know, the nose hurts just a little bit, but I'm all right." She said, "Well, how'd you do?" Plate was clean. It was very clean. Said, "I did just great." It's a little tough though, getting the butter on the biscuit. If you and I aren't uncomfortable, we aren't learning. Well, it was a short time after that, doctors and nurses brought me into a separate room. They said, "All right, there are different terrains in life." I said, "No kidding." They said, "You got hills and concrete, gravel, carpet, padding underneath of carpet, because of the strength which you'll never have. And nor if you really get around at all in life, we need to order you an electric wheelchair." I know it sounds like a lot of fun, but I was 21 years old at the time. At that age, I had learned how to ask the truly important questions in life. And so I asked, I said, "Can you tell me? What color do electric wheelchairs come in?" And they said, well, it's chrome. Well, I didn't have a lot that was chrome in my wardrobe. And so I asked, I said, can you tell me what color the manual wheelchairs come in? And they said, well, purple and red and yellow and green and black and blue. I said, I mean, I'd like to have one of those, thank you. And there were many other reasons besides color. They said, I'll tell you what, Art. We have an inside track in the hospital, which is an eighth of a mile long, and it's on linoleum. They said, if you can push around that track in less than 30 minutes, we'll let you have a manual wheelchair. I thought, what a democracy. Isn't it great to be in America? And so I agreed. The morning event arrived, and doctors and nurses all stood around, anxious to see if I would finish. Stopwatch in hand to mark my progress. Piece of tape across the floor that marked the starting and the finish line. And then they clicked the watch and they said, go. Might as well not said anything. It took me about 5 minutes just to get across the line. It's a very thick tape. Once I got over that first speed bump, had momentum on my side. I felt good and strong and confident. I thought I could conquer the world. I have to admit, though, it was a little embarrassing when the old man in the walker passed me. That's all right. I caught up with him later and I knocked it out from under him. In California, they call that therapy. Well, I got down to the end of that first hallway and I thought I'd taken a wrong turn as my arms and shoulders began to tire and I wondered if I'd ever finish. I went down the second hallway, the third, and finally the last, and I crossed over that line just one more time in exactly 28 minutes. And so I got my manual wheelchair. You know, it wasn't long after that when I wondered if I'd made such a good decision in my life. It was that time of the year when I had to go shopping by myself. So I went to a mall in San Jose called Eastridge Mall. Three stories high, 196 stores. I was on the third level, need the third back down to the second again. Now, if you can visualize with me for a moment, they have these long sloping ramps which go from one level down to the next. Yeah, I should have thought of that too. Do you know, as I sat at the top of that great abyss and I looked down into the valley below, I was so sure, so confident that I could manage that kind of a fall that I waited for everybody else to get off the ramp. And then I pushed off. Joey knows an interesting happened when I pushed off. I accelerated. And I started to go faster and faster. Now I don't have the use of my hands, so I can only put outside pressure on the rings. I put more and more pressure on the rings and I kept going faster and faster. I put more and more pressure on the rings and I kept going faster and faster. I thought if I made a real ugly face at that might help. You know it does in football. And so I did, and it didn't. It only scared everybody. It's about that time, though, that I had a revelation. Realized for the first time in my life what my high school physics teacher had been trying to teach me. When she said that when you couple the law of gravity with the law of momentum, you get freeway speeds. Well, it was about that time I began to smell burning flesh coming from my hands, and so I knew I was in trouble. Now, being the good Boy Scout that I was obviously more concerned for the safety of young mothers and their children at the bottom of the ramp than I would be for myself. I mean, after all, what more can you do to hurt a quadriplegic? Figured maybe I'd fix something. So I began to wave my arms, Galloway! Galloway! Mothers ran to the right, children ran to the left. Johnny knows an interesting happened when I went like this. I accelerated. I hit the bottom of that ramp and I was at full speed. Now I don't know how fast I was going, 80. 90 miles an hour. So I raced right down the middle of all those good folks, and I'm a lucky man. There was a store in front of me. The name across the front of the store was A. Hirsch and Son Jewelers. Yeah. I don't know how many of you ever heard of a bull in a china shop, but this bull is doing 100 miles an hour. And I had a feeling I was about to become a part of their layaway program. Well, I raced right down the middle of that store, and I continued to wave my arms. Golly! Salesmen were jumping over counters. Customers hid behind pedestals. They thought they were safe. Nobody was safe. But the man who really looked worried was the man behind the repair counter. He was in the line, all there was. His eyes about as big as saucers and getting bigger. Showing the look on his face, like he knew we were going to get acquainted. Well, I'm a lucky man. There was carpeting on the floor with thick padding underneath. So I began to slow down. I came to a stop right in front of the repair counter. I know what some of you are thinking. I can see it in your eyes. Some of you actually wished I'd hit the repair counter. Just so I'd have a better story. Well, I didn't, and the repairman looked down on the top of the counter, and he said, "Can I help you?" You know, there are about 100 folks behind me. They're wondering the same thing. I said, "Yes, sir. Can you tell me what time it is? I'm in an awful hurry." Sometimes you and I miss the greatest miracles of life because we are simply in a hurry. Went back to that same hospital about a year and a half after I left it. Decided to try that indoor track just one more time. The one that had previously taken me 28 minutes. This time there were no doctors or nurses. There was no stopwatch, only the second hand of my watch, and the piece of tape was still across the floor, cracked and yellowing. And then I took off. And exactly 1 minute. 58 seconds later, I crossed the line again. Now, some people wouldn't call that a miracle, but I do. For the first time in my young life, I learned that dreams are never destroyed by circumstances. Dreams are born in the heart and in the mind, and only there can they ever die. Since that day, I now own and operate my own company. I travel more than 150,000 miles a year. Learn to drive again. I am completely independent, and I take care of myself. Got married to that same beautiful and wonderful girl a year and a half after that fateful day, and enjoy two beautiful children. Returned to the world of sports, where now I play full contact rugby. I race marathons, and last year I became the first quadriplegic in the world to race 320 miles in 7 days. I had a friend ask me, he said, "Art, if you could go back, if you could change it all, if you could have loved a different girl, if you could have driven during the day in order to avoid the pain and the struggle of your life, would you?" My answer is simple, but my answer is this: no. Now, some of you may not understand. Some of you may even think I'm crazy. That's all right. If you knew what I knew, if you've been where I've been, if you've seen what I've seen and heard what I have heard, then you would echo with me when I say, I thank God that life is hard. Why? Because in the pain and the struggle, in the frustration, the loneliness, the discouragement, and the rejection, you and I begin to learn. And when we learn, we grow. And when we grow, then the greatest miracle of all happens. You and I begin to change. You see, of all God's creatures, large and small, that walk or crawl upon the face of this earth, only you and I are afforded the great miracle called change. We can change who we are. We can change the directions of our lives. We can change what we think and what we do. You and I can change. Why? Because a long time ago, man, a God, loved you and me enough to die. And because he did, change means something. Oh, I believe in miracles. I really do. But I also know that some miracles, some dreams, some impossibilities just take time. And thank God for that. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.